Buddy, good evening. So I want to return to a question from a couple of weeks ago. It's a challenging question, a bit of a difficult question for some of us, more than others. And the question is, why are we here? And I don't mean so much here tonight in this house, but why are we here, really, in this life? One of the possible responses to that question is that we're here to awaken. We're here to awaken out of the trance of ignorance, of delusion, of confusion, the trance of emotional affliction, the trance of misunderstanding. We're here to awaken out of what appears to be our troubles, our woes, our complications, our suffering. Now, if we don't know in some way, through some kind of direct experience or some kind of example that we see apparently outside of ourselves, about a possibility of being free from that which might affect us, and we might not even know that's possible. We need to somehow be exposed to the possibility that our life can be at times considerably more at ease than it is in order to even consider that endeavor, you might say. Because the trance of ignorance, of delusion, of misunderstanding, in a way is all pervasive until, you might say, the light of awareness begins to poke through it. Until we begin to realize what illumination actually is for ourselves, it may not be something that in any way we're even considering or interested in. So for some of us, we read about a potential that attracts our attention, and that it appears to be something we've not experienced in our life, and then we become interested in it. Another way it happens is we encounter someone who's exhibiting qualities, ways of moving through their life that's attractive. And we see a potential through that relationship, let's say, for us also to experience, let's say, a greater love or a greater generosity. I remember once, many, many years ago, I was in undergraduate college and very socially awkward most of the time with more than one person, and oftentimes I was socially awkward just with one other person. But if it went to 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 or 20, the anxiety inside just seemed to grow exponentially. And there was a sense that, you know, why does it have to be like this? Why can't I be at ease with people? Something about this seems off. Why should I be so uptight about just talking and listening and laughing and being at the party? And I was at a party of about 20 people once. It was a very memorable experience, and there was a fellow there who was sitting, you know, with everybody else, some people standing, some sitting, you know. And he was communicating about something that he called physical culture, which was, I never heard anything like this, and I still don't remember much of anything that he said. But what I remember was that he was sitting and expressing himself, and he seemed to be completely comfortable. He seemed to be completely at ease. And those who were listening, and eventually I was one that was listening too, seemed very interested in what he was saying. And he was kind of laughing, people were laughing with him, and it seemed very free, and I felt very much outside of that. Have you ever been there? I see at least half the heads in the room nodding. So the other half of you have something to look forward to. No, I'm like, yeah. And I noticed that, you know, he was exhibiting something that I felt I was incapable of. Like, that is not my experience. But that sure looks good. Very interesting. So So we see a potential somewhere. It's through a reading, through the presentation of another being. Or we imagine it. We imagine. We don't necessarily read about it. We don't necessarily see it through the example of another person. But we imagine that life can be different. Life can be freer. Life can be easier. And that imagination, or that reading, or that example of another person doesn't take us there, in most cases. So if at least one answer to why we are here is to awaken from that which appears to limit us, restrict us, to in a way, energetically, psychologically, emotionally, and perhaps even spiritually, appear to imprison us. Isn't that what religious traditions and spirituality, if you really boil it down to the nitty-gritty, isn't that what they're on the planet for? Is to get us somehow awakened and tuned in to something that we've apparently lost or apparently never had. Of course, the problem sometimes is that as we listen to these traditions, are we listening to an authentic voice? Are we listening to something that we can say, you know what, that's reliable. I'm going to listen to that, and not only that, but I'm going to act upon that. There's a lot of hypocrisy, a lot of delusion, a lot of confusion, a lot of ignorance in the name of religion, in the name of spirituality. So we have an inborn ability to discern. We have somewhat what people call a gut sense or a heart sense of what feels right or what we sense is right. And we're probably listening to this much more than we often realize. That we're making decisions based upon this. That we're living our life according to something that we ourselves might not have thought out very carefully. But when that's something that guides us, that you could call it gut sense or intuition or heart sense or knowing, begins to operate in relation to that which potentially, in terms of, let's say, a teaching, can free us from what we ourselves personally, and sometimes very personally, know feels like a restriction or inhibition. And we begin to line up our own gut sense of how to move with, how to operate within, how to work with, how to transform the conditions of our life. Then we are tapping into a part of what meditation is deeply and fundamentally about in the relative world. We'll talk about it in terms of conventional truths, relativity. And I think I was saying here before, it's really important to get a sense of how to be within the field of relativity, peacefully, harmoniously. How to work with the conditions of your life, illness, aging, sexual identity, sexual expression, relationship to materiality, to creativity, to money, to possessions, to somehow find a way to be amongst these things, let you be at ease amongst these things. Because if you're not at ease amongst these things, would it not be sensible to say it's going to be difficult to transcend and move beyond conditions? You see, because even if I have a glimpse of something beyond conditionality, and yet the conditions of my life are not in order. My house, metaphorically, is not in order. It's going to pull me right back in. That's why in certain spiritual teachings and psychological teachings as well, the concept of spiritual bypass has become very, very important. It's being studied extensively by some people. How human beings, in the name of freeing themselves at times, will bypass certain things about their emotional life, their developmental process, their relational process, and attached to a spiritual experience of some kind, an insight of some kind, and then they're vulnerable to being pulled right back in. I remember the first time I put on scuba gear and I didn't have a license. Anyways, a friend of mine gave me all the stuff and I put it all on. And he explained to me, you know, it felt a little edgy, but I felt, I can do this. So I put the stuff on, and there was this massive weight belt. He said, here, put this on too. So I put the weight belt on. He said, okay, go for it. I got in the water, and I just went, next thing you know, I'm like 30 feet down, and my ears are doing this. You know, I knew how to change pressure, but I was like, And those of you who scuba dive, you know, Paul, what are you, stupid? At least take, you know, 101. So if there's unresolved experiences in the emotional body, unresolved experience in the developmental process, unresolved things mentally, and I have a glimpse and I open up to something very spacious and apparently beyond all that, and I'm, wow, I'm out, I'm free, you know, really open. Next thing you know, the bill comes and it's like, holy smokes, it went up $50. All of a sudden, this contraction. So in a way, perhaps why we're here is to work with all aspects of our experience. All aspects of what it means to be a human being, in the fullest sense of what that could mean. To work with, to know, to understand. You might even say, simply put, to become truly comfortable within our own skin. Okay? And how often are you truly comfortable with your own within your own skin? And what are the issues that arise within this skin body, this mind-body process? What are the issues that arise? Some people, after a period of time of examining this, they go, you know what? The issue of my life, it's not just the issues. The issue of my life is, boom, and they can name what is their sort of existential issue. And some people will go so far as to say, the issue of this life. Now, I would stop that person right there and I'd say, do you know what you're talking about? Because you just suggested that you're having one lifetime amongst many. Do you know what you're talking about? Or are you just buying a theory that you like? Okay, we can begin to speak in a way, act in a way, move in a way, where we're connected with our direct experience. Not a theory, not an idea. And good therapy, yeah, and effective meditation practice supports this deeply. This, get us connected. So we're connected as much of the time as possible to our direct experience of what's happening. And within that direct experience of what's happening, what we discover is, just to use one term, issues arise, complications, challenges arise. It could be in the emotional body. How are you when anger arises? Your anger. Not somebody else's or somebody else's. Because if you have something that's difficult in you when somebody else is angry, what is that? It's probably something about your own anger or fear. What about that? What happens when loss occurs? Inevitable loss of this or that. So you're communicating with a human being yesterday, and the human being, this particular human being, has an issue that's been around for 30 years, give or take a few. And the issue is fear of sudden death. It's an interesting construction. Fear of sudden death. Not so much fear of death, but fear of sudden death. Once upon a time, about 30 years ago, he's walking on the beach up in Long Island with another person, and they were communicating about different things, and the conversation was moving around. And pretty soon, he got in touch with, and very powerfully and very quickly, this fear that at some point in his life, of course, and this is a possibility, he might die suddenly. Just no preparation, just boom. And he had a panic attack immediately. Boom. Why did he have a panic attack? Simple answer. I don't want to die suddenly. So why have a panic attack? Because you don't want to die suddenly. Because that's the best way I know how to defend against having what I don't want. Irony is, that doesn't work. And doesn't help. So, 3 decades later, the fear of sudden death is still around. And the panic attacks are still around. Anybody in this room ever had a panic attack? Not just some anxiety, but a panic attack. Can we distinguish that? Anxiety is... Panic attack is this thing goes... It really flips out. And you can watch it happen. Okay? But the heart could be going... The breath is going... And it's completely and utterly and totally out of control for some period of time. It does end. And in most cases, you don't have a sudden death. But some people think they're going to have a sudden death when they're having a panic attack. And so it's important for them to go in and have their heart checked out by somebody who they trust who can say, Paul, your heart is perfectly fine. Let me show you the data. Hopefully that goes in and I go, oh, when my heart's going like this, that doesn't mean I'm having a heart attack. It means I'm having a panic attack. Those are two different things. And if it works, I mean the information, I relax. And that condition or tendency to react to what? The reality of dying, the possibility of sudden death, the insurance bill or auto insurance or this or that changing, somebody leaving me a note, goodbye, elevators moving up and down, storms coming. Some people have panic attacks when you have a storm like today. The storm comes in, panic attack. That's a condition. As is depression. So if you look at your life and you see that there are these opportunities, let's shift the language from problem to issue to opportunity, and perhaps part of why you're here is to explore, investigate, navigate, and ultimately transform and transcend those difficulties. Because if you don't do it for yourself, who's going to do it for you? Who's going to take you out? And even if somebody's really nice, like that guy, I was watching him for a while, and he was being really happy and friendly with everybody at the party. Everybody seemed to like him. That's the part that bugged me. They liked that guy. And he's getting the juice. And I'm sitting over here going, I like it, but I don't have it. I still don't have it. Because there's nothing to get there that's truly going to satisfy you. Everybody loves you. Everybody's attentive to you. How long is that going to last in terms of your happiness? The actual sense of deep well-being and okayness in your life, about this long. Otherwise, everybody in Hollywood would be the happiest, healthiest people on the planet. And it doesn't seem to be the case, does it? I love the two-week marriage. We only blew $1 million on the marriage ceremony, and we're getting divorced now in 2 weeks. Some of the happiest, healthiest people, they're not really even in public very much. Or if they are, they're pretty low key. They're not making a big scene. CNN hasn't got their camera on them. We are now documenting the happiest person on Tuesday. Please say something for us. Give us the secret to your happiness. Dalai Lama hooked up with this fellow and wrote a book together with this guy called The Art of Happiness. I think the Dalai Lama sat down and the guy had a couple conversations with him. The guy wrote the book. And I think what was going on in that book, if you ever see that book, is that that guy was trying to figure out how to be happy. You can get a title out of that in some cases. Art of Happiness. It didn't really seem like the art nor the science of happiness to me. But it was a decent book nonetheless. Interesting if you've ever seen it. You might concur with some of my interpretations. That's all those were. Not facts. Except they're interpretive facts. So we get into this sort of possibility of connecting to the factuality of our life. That's what the Dharma is connecting to the facts, not the interpretations. Not the conjectures, not the assumptions, not the imaginations, but the facts. And we begin to discover something very deep about the facts. That the facts are inherently, continuously, unmistakably friendly once we recognize them in their true nature. They're intrinsically, inherently friendly in that they're here to help us. The facts of all situations. You say, wow, that's really? The fact of getting cancer, going through treatment, the fact of having my back go out again, the fact of these ongoing subtle, sometimes not so subtle, but it seems to always be there, ache in my head. Moves around, but it's there, this ache, this weight, this thing. My drying eyes, my plugged sinus, all that same emotional reaction. Yes, all of it. Because if it isn't your friend, then it must be some variation of your enemy. And if you're at odds with it, then you aren't the awareness that's watching that. You are subject to that. It's got you by the tail. So in a way, the art of happiness, at least as I put it tonight, is the art of transformation. Is getting connected enough with initially things just like the breathing and the bodily experience, which is actually quite a bit, such that you see how transformation works. You see that the nature of bodily form, and that includes breathing form, you know, breathing formation, is constant, incessant, by nature, transformation. Evolution, yeah, or transformation. Formation of forms. And we're not going into that sublime area that we've looked at the last couple of weeks. We're just staying in the conventional, apparently dualistic frame right now. And the power of our observation can get stronger and stronger. The power of our equanimity can get deeper and deeper. As those two things deepen, yeah, the awareness and the balance, the equanimity, we begin to experience more readily and easily and effortlessly tranquility. It initially can come just as the body being comfortable, body being unagitated, breath being settled. When I say body, I also mean the mental space, the head, quiets, becomes still, peaceful. It's not agitated, it's not racing, it's not running, it's not grasping. The monkey mind quiets down. Begin to see this. Wow. And it doesn't last. Begin to realize that there's no point in holding on to any particular experience or any particular state. That's not what transformation is about. That's not the art of happiness. Holding on to something. Trying to keep something. And it also doesn't make any sense to try to avoid the facts, the difficult facts that inevitably come, a little or a lot, every single day. Every single 12 waking hours, there's some irritant, would you agree? Little, a lot, sometimes that was an irritating day. Seemed to not end. Maybe tomorrow will be different. Can't wait to go unconscious and dying to be out of this. Way better choice to go to sleep when thinking like that than to go, oh, I just need about 7 martinis. That's what I need. No, that's not what you need. That's confusion talking. Now you're going to take a difficult situation and put some toxic liquid on top of that and go, I'm better. I forget my pain. So we can make choices to stay with, we can make choices to avoid, we can make big choices to avoid, but whatever we avoid, generally, we can discover this directly and clearly, it comes back around in one form or another. It's very powerful to see this. If we meditate long enough, so to speak, what we begin to see is that it's all in there. Remember things that were like, holy smokes, did I do that? And I felt that way about it. And it was like that. I didn't even see that angle before. I didn't see that angle before. I didn't see that angle before. You start seeing things from many different angles. It's almost like here's an experience, okay? And you initially saw it right from here. And maybe you also saw that you could see it from here. You saw two different vantage points. What happens in the meditation, you start to see it from different vantage points until eventually it's almost like you've got a 360 view of it. You can look at it from so many different vantage points, including the vantage point of other beings. It's a very deep intimacy, and initially sometimes it's frightening because it's holy smokes. Is this what it means to open up? Yeah. And as you get more and more open, it becomes clear that actually there's nothing to fear. There was Eastern teacher named Swami Muktananda, who came to this country back in the 70s. And he was a very powerful, what they call in India, a siddhi yogi. And what he would do with his disciples is he would touch him here, or he'd touch him with a peacock feather. That was one of the ones that he liked to do with the peacock feather. And for some people, their kundalini would go up. And lots of different things would happen. Anyways, he's a very interesting guy. And the story I want to tell you about him is that he one day realized that he was going to die. All of us probably have thought that. Yes, I'm going to die. Death is going to happen to this. Doesn't mean you're going to die, but death is going to happen to this. This is going to die. Now, he didn't just think this, and he didn't just kind of contemplate this. It's like he deeply knew this. Okay? It's different. Then he sat for meditation. Okay, he went into meditation. And while he was meditating, he died. And when he died, he peed. Bladder let go. He came back. And he reported to those that knew him that all fear went away. Not only was all fear of death gone, but all fear was gone. Think about this for a minute. Where's the primal fear in this? Where is it and what is it? And the answer becomes clear when we look deeply. Fear, in the fundamental primal sense that operates within this form, is fear of annihilation of this form, which is connected to attachment to this form, which is connected to I am this form. And you are this form. You're not only this form, though. That's the shift. So, in a playful way, because he's a very playful guy, he wasn't very playful with me because I think he felt I was a knucklehead. So instead of hitting me with the feather, he grabbed the back of my head and started poking me, almost like between the eyes, but he hit my brow like about 10 times, probably because I needed it. And then he pushed me to the side slightly, and I kind of fell over and was like, I don't feel any different, except that you just poked my third eye for about 5, 7, 10 times. It was meaningfully unspiritual. I guess he's not my teacher. Yes, he was. He just had his own method. Everybody else was getting the peacock feather. Light touch on the head, cross the cheek, you know, grabs me. That's literally what happened. All in the name of, you know, I'm trying to go somewhere. Maybe you can help me. You see? Because that's what that leads you into sometimes, is maybe you have what I need, and maybe you'll take me somewhere. So poke me between the eyes and help me. I didn't understand this that I'm saying to you now. I didn't understand what was motivating. I must begin to see what is motivating. Why am I doing this? And I don't mean that like intellectually, oh, why am I doing that? No, you've been to feel why you're doing things. Not just how you're doing things, but deeply sensing, why am I doing this? Not something to figure out, it's something to experience. And as you experience it, lo and behold, from the inside, things do start to get figured out. They do start to get sorted out. Things begin to slowly but surely make sense. And your relationship and your intimacy with the facts and that deep possibility that all the facts of life are friendly begins to guide you and teach you. Because that now is another way of saying the Dharma itself guides your life. That's what in Christianity they mean when they say, not my will, but thy will. The direct translation of that into Buddhist teachings is, the Dharma guides your life. The laws, yeah, of the relative world, and understanding those laws. What are those laws? Karma. Act from generosity, you'll have more generosity in your life. Act from greed, anger, fear, sadness, depression, jealousy, you'll have more of those in your life. It's a straight deal. Now, I'm not saying, you know, it's necessarily immediate, because sometimes people act from greed for 20 years and they don't see that they're becoming more greedy. What they see is that they're having more and more and more, and they're happier, and I have more and more and more. They don't see the flip side of that, that what they're accumulating is completely and utterly and forever not theirs. Even though their name is all over the titles. Not a strange thing to call it? The American Indians never had that. They didn't own land. Yeah, they fought for their land. They protected their spaces. But they didn't own it with their name on it. This is ours, not yours. Different concept. I think I could probably stop here. Should I stop here? Do you have something you want to talk about on this theme? Transformation, working with experience, working with your life, facts are friendly. We can get more deeply into how, I think that might be useful, to really get as deep as we can into the practicality of how to work with the conditions of life. Now, I could talk about my conditions, the things that challenge. You could talk about your condition. You could talk about how you work with those conditions.
So I have a weird Darwinian reductionist rap clinging to life. Because I tend to